What I have found in the work that I have been doing most recently is that we need to recognize that when individuals come into these settings, they have been abused, neglected, traumatized. They are often very fearful. Sometimes the behaviors that we see and label as being very aggressive and intimidating are the coping mechanisms that this person has learned to keep themselves safe.
So the Hawk Foundation seeks to raise awareness of the prevalence and influence of trauma in the lives of mental health consumers and the ways in which trauma affects behavior. In particular, the use of seclusion and restraint in treatment settings can pose a significant risk of harm to consumers and staffers. And so throughout the mental health care system, there's a desire for less traumatic methods of intervening with individuals in distress. And so with us today is Arise Hayes. She is a Senior Vice President of Operations for the MANTS system, which trains organizations in how to intervene in emergency situations. And she's with us here today to drop some wisdom on this issue that's of prime importance to the Hawk Foundation. So, Arise, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. So, from just taking, if I may, the layman's perspective for a second, when everyone thinks restraint, in psychiatric settings at least, the first image that often comes to mind is that of, the old straight jacket. Not only is this image out of date, but it also may create the impression that restraints are actually something that's far more dramatic and something that's used a lot less frequently, maybe, than they actually are. So for the layperson, what exactly is seclusion and restraint? And in your experience, what does that term include?
Well, that's a very interesting question because we're going to focus on the mental health system. And we can focus on the state of Texas, but also national definitions. The national definition of restraint is the immobilization of a body or a portion of a body. And that's a very important part. People don't always realize that if you are immobilizing someone's arm, that is considered to be a restraint. So it can be either immobilizing a portion of a body or the entire body. You can use physical restraint, meaning it's just one person manually controlling the movement of the other person. There are mechanical restraints, like a straitjacket. By the way, I want you to know I was awarded a straitjacket from the Department of Mental Health and Mental Retardation.
Oh, really?
Because they reduced the use of that so much and they didn't need it anymore. It was kind of like a prize.
My goodness.
Yes, I've kept it away from my children. I'm afraid they might use it against me. They're both bigger than I am. You can also use medications in a way that will help to slow or immobilize an individual. That is a much more controversial and less frequently discussed manner of restraint. In Texas, the idea of a chemical restraint is illegal. We don't do chemical restraints. However, we do administer emergency medication without the consent of the individual in an emergency situation, which often results in the individual going to sleep. Most of us would consider that to be a chemical restraint. You can call it whatever you want, but that's what it is. You're knocking people out by administering some type of medication to them against their will.
Okay. And so can you summarize what we know or think that we know about the harm that seclusion and restraint can possibly do when it's improperly deployed?
Interesting question. And actually, it doesn't matter whether it's properly or improperly employed. There is no such thing as a safe restraint, not to the individual being restrained or to the individuals administering the restraints. There are times that there are physical injuries that occur. The ultimate physical injury is when someone dies subsequent to the use of restraint. And unfortunately, we don't know how often these injuries or deaths occur because In the United States, as in most countries, we don't have a comprehensive system where we have common definitions, common reporting requirements, and common data collection requirements so that we can compare this information across states and ultimately across systems so that we can actually learn from each other and understand how often this is occurring. And if some entity is having to use restraints less often than another, what are they doing right that maybe we can adopt in other systems? There are physical injuries that occur, not only to the individuals that are being restrained, but quite often to the staff members that might be involved in restraining someone. In fact, there is some data that indicates that staff members are injured at twice the rate of individuals receiving services during a restraint. I'm not sure why that occurs. In many programs, people, the staff members, may be taught to actually restrain someone and take them to the ground and immobilize them on the ground. Sometimes when that happens, the staff is hitting the ground and the individual is ending up on top of that individual. And that may be one of the reasons why the staff injuries occur as frequently as they do. But we really don't know. There hasn't been a lot of research around this area. But the physical injuries are only a part of the picture. We're talking about human service organizations, organizations that are there to provide treatment to individuals with disabilities, or people that are elderly, people that are very, very young. And many of those individuals have gone through significant traumatic experiences. They have already been traumatized. It is also a traumatizing event to take someone out of a place that they are comfortable with, they're familiar with, they're surrounded by people that they know and to some degree trust, and to place them in a residential setting where they have basically three changes of shift that they did not hire, they cannot fire, they have no control over them, but they're completely dependent on them. And so it's a very frightening situation. At the least, having to be restrained is traumatizing or re-traumatizing, quite often for very vulnerable individuals that are already subjected to extreme trauma.
Okay. So I would just assume that there probably isn't anyone out there who is ever proud of having to resort to seclusion and restraint. So for, you know, for everyone, I would think, or almost everyone, who would sincerely like to reduce its use, what do they report as being, you know, the most significant obstacles or challenges to making that happen?
Well, if you talk to individuals, it depends on who you talk with. If you're talking to direct care staff, they're going to say, well, we don't have the time, we don't have the resources, we don't have the staff. If you're talking to administrators, sometimes there's finger pointing going on saying there's not adequate training and we don't have adequate resources. What we found is that you often don't have to have a lot of financial resources, and you don't necessarily have to have an increase in the number of staff members in order to successfully reduce the use of restraints. And in fact, a lot of individuals will say, I would prefer to have the right staff than to have the correct number of staff. That's what makes the difference. It's how those staff members are working with each other and how they're interacting with the individuals that they are supposed to be caring for that might make a difference.
Okay. And so I would imagine that that schooling people in alternatives is really, it's an ongoing process.
It should be.
Of change and growth. So it may be hard to reduce it to just a few bullet points, but I thought that I might ask anyway, you know, about effective alternatives to seclusion and restraint. And what those might be, you know, for those who want to avoid, you know, the worst case scenarios that, you know, that you've alluded to.
Well, it's interesting that you asked that. I want to start from kind of a high level and then maybe bring it down to a lower level.
Yeah.
The Hogg Foundation has been very helpful in bringing those educational resources to Texas. There, over the last 20 years or so, we have gotten information from NASHBID, the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. These are the individuals that own and operate the state hospitals. And as you mentioned, they've been working to reduce the use of restraint and seclusion longer than any other system because they were using it so much. And they developed an education organization called NTAC, the National Technical Assistance Center. The director of that at the time that it developed was an RN, PhD level RN by the name of Kevin Huckshorn. She and her group, NTAC, developed what has been called the six core strategies to reduce the use of restraint and seclusion. The reason I want to bring this up first is because most administrators, policymakers, legislators are going to say, we want you to use evidence-based practices. I have a real problem with that because not enough people are doing the research to develop evidence-based practices. Any practice had to be something before it became evidence-based. So I don't want to throw out all the practices that may be promising. However, the substance abuse, SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, has deemed the six core strategies to reduce the use of restraint and seclusion as an evidence-based practice. And although it originated through work with the state hospitals and psychiatric systems, their six core strategies are applicable to any type of setting and any population. Unfortunately, as I travel around the country, I'm very disappointed to realize that very few organizations are actually using the six core strategies. Many of them have never heard of the six core strategy. So I appreciate the opportunity to let people know that that's available. And if they just Google six core strategies, they can get all that background information.
Okay.
But you were asking, maybe on a different level, what can we do to reduce the use of restraint? And what I have found in the work that I have been doing most recently is that we need to recognize that when individuals come into these settings, they have been abused, neglected, traumatized. They are often very fearful. Sometimes the behaviors that we see and label as being very aggressive and intimidating are the coping mechanisms that this person has learned to keep themselves safe, to kind of give themselves space and to make people back off. But sometimes we don't pick up on those cues and respond appropriately. One of the things that we talk about in the class that I teach is, you know, if you were to walk up toward a dog and the dog started to growl and start baring its teeth, what do? You back off. Same thing with a cat. If they're hissing, they're bowing their back, letting you see their claws, that's a signal. They want you to back off, and that's typically what we do. Unfortunately, when it comes to individuals in our care and treatment, quite often, caregivers do the exact opposite. Instead of backing off, quieting down, giving that person space and time to get control over themselves by feeling safe, we walk up on them. We get closer to them. And at a brainstem level, that entity is feeling they have to protect themselves, and so they start to lash out at the caregiver. And that's how that restraint is then justified. What we need to learn is how to help that person develop trust with the people that are providing care and treatment for them. Whether it's in a home or in a residential setting or a classroom setting, one of the easiest ways to help people to de-escalate is by having a relationship with someone that they can care about and who cares about them and trusts that that person's watching out for them is going to help to protect them.
Okay. So I would like to know a little bit more about you and where you come from. How it is that you came to be, you know, so deeply engaged with this particular issue, and I guess the steps that you've gone through in sort of your evolving understanding of it, and then also, you know, your work for MANTS system, and you know what you might tell us about the organization, its mission and philosophy, and how you came to be involved.
I grew up in Detroit, Michigan. And I graduated from Michigan State with a degree in psychology. There is a long history of mental illness in my family. Both my mother and my brother were diagnosed as having schizophrenia. Neither of them had schizophrenia. They had a bipolar disorder. And if you've ever lived with someone with a bipolar disorder, you can tell the difference. So I had a lot of practical experience seeing behaviors of individuals diagnosed with a mental illness, but also seeing how things progressed, depending how caregivers interacted with them. I ran away from Detroit as soon as I graduated from Michigan State, and I came here to Austin, and there's not much that you can do with a degree, a bachelor's degree in psychology. I started working as a social worker at the Austin State Hospital. I did that for 13 years, and obviously I got to see a lot of aggressive situations and how staff were taught to deal with those. I started working at the Texas Department of Mental Health and Mental Retardation, when it existed, as a client abuse investigator and client rights officer. I did that for 2 years, and again, had an opportunity to review many allegations and investigations involving the use of restraint or seclusion, allegations of abuse or neglect. Eventually, I left that job and I started working for the Protection and Advocacy System here in Texas. That is a federally funded, federally mandated organization whose charge is to protect, promote, but more importantly, advance the rights of individuals with disabilities. I coordinated the Protection and Advocacy for Individuals with Mental Illness program, PAMI, for 19 years. At the same time, I was using my previous skills as an investigator to support employees that were doing direct client advocacy and were doing investigations, particularly investigations having to do with allegations of abuse and neglect, and many of those had to do with restraint and seclusion. I was doing a lot of policy work working for the Protection and Advocacy System, and sometimes that policy work had to do with regulations around investigations or regulations around the use of interventions for emergency situations. So I developed a lot of information, a lot of background, both personal and professional. I like to tell people, you know, whether you believe in nature or nurture, I've got it coming and going. I figure I need to fix the system before I have to use it myself. So I really have had a passion for trying to work on policies about how people with disabilities are being treated. As a policy person, as we were working on regulations governing the use of restraint and seclusion, I felt that it was important for me to learn what different entities were teaching people about how to intervene in emergency situations. So I started going to a lot of different training programs. One of the programs that I went to was the MAD system, because they actually allowed people from the Protection and Advocacy System to sit through their training for free, which was very unusual. Most vendors don't want the PNA sitting in observing what it is that they are teaching people. The MAD system actually developed an advisory committee and invited me to participate on it, which provided an attitude of transparency that I thought was lacking in many other systems or with many other training organizations. I became certified as a MAT instructor, but I never used it. I was just doing that from the perspective of the PNA to see what they were teaching people. But I was so impressed by what the MAT system was teaching that I actually ended up promoting that. And that's very unusual for someone working in a protection and advocacy system whose focus is really on reducing, if not completely eliminating, the use of restraint and seclusion. The reason I felt comfortable promoting the MAD system is because the first time that I went into the training, one of the very first things I heard was, if this is not something that you would do with your mother, father, sister, brother, you don't do it to anybody else. Their focus was on teaching caregivers how to treat people, not just the people that they're serving, but also their coworkers, consistently with respect and dignity, because that can help to develop that trusting relationship. You may have had a situation where at some point you were kind of angry, frustrated, maybe wanted to lash out at somebody, but if there was someone with you that you knew and trusted, that you felt had your back, it's easier for you to control your impulses and to be able to de-escalate. And so on a practical basis, that made sense to me. It resonated. The rest of the training really reinforces that type of information. The idea that if you are treating people with respect and dignity, developing trust, working on how you are communicating with people so that you're aware of how your verbal and your nonverbal communication skills can either escalate or de-escalate a situation, I think gets very practical information about how to develop relationships so that you are more likely to be able to support someone when they start to get agitated or angry or aggressive, and help them to control their impulses.
Okay. And so, poking around on the MANT website, I saw that under solutions, just because I was curious, you have links for practitioner, for leadership, for service users, and direct support professional.
Yes.
Can you say some things about how you, tailor your approach for, for these different groups?
Well, the information that is there on the website, and by the way, thank you for doing that. It is a work in progress. We are trying to make it much easier for people to find information.
I know all about websites.
It's not an easy task, and to think the way that the majority of the world thinks can be very, very challenging. But we recognize that when people are looking for vendors of this type of training, it's different people that may be looking. You need to think about it from the perspective of direct support professionals, direct care staff. But you also need to think about the people that are going to be determining, are we going to pay for this? So you need to have the policymakers or administrators so that they can focus on some of the things that they are most concerned about, like return on investment. How is this going to pay for itself in the long run? Then you have middle management. They're concerned about, yes, we need to meet these regulations, we got to get training, but we also have to have enough staff that are going to be able to meet our staff-client ratios. And so there's information that I think is very helpful for them to understand how we can help to meet those needs as well. So we have different information geared toward the responsibility and roles that those individuals may play within their system. But the training is the same regardless of what that individual's role or responsibility is. That being said, we believe that when a vendor is looking at this type of training event, quite often you're looking at changing your culture. And we believe that that type of change works best when it starts at the top and then comes down. It is very difficult to get your direct care staff to consistently treat each other and the people they care for with respect and dignity if they themselves are not experiencing it from their supervisors or from their administrators. To that end, we do have 1- and 2-day events like supporting successful management, corporate culture change, enhancing educational opportunities. This is geared toward leadership so that they understand the concepts that are being taught to the direct care staff, and they can model those behaviors and support the individuals that are actually doing the instruction. I'm not sure that everybody understands. Primarily what the MANT system is teaching is a train the trainers type of curriculum. We have people come in basically for a 5-day training event, and they get certified to go back to their setting and then teach the people that are within their organization.
Okay. We are talking to Arise Hayes of the MANT system. Please check out their website. MANT is spelled M-A-N-D-T, and the web address is www.mantsystem.com. They've got their hands in a lot of different things, and as she alluded to, so much that it's been a bit of a challenge distilling it all down, but it's always wonderful to be able to meet a living, breathing example of the kind of change that the Hogg Foundation is trying to affect in the world. And so we thank you so much for finding the time to talk to us.
As I said, I appreciate the opportunity.
The Hogg Foundation is not new to the issue of seclusion and restraint. In 2007, we launched the Seclusion and Restraint Reduction Leadership Group, a working group of mental health experts and stakeholders, clinicians, agency leaders, advocates and consumers, who are committed to reducing the use of seclusion and restraint in a wide range of settings. As we have discussed in this episode, seclusion and restraints are too often used to control people in settings such as schools, psychiatric hospitals, juvenile detention centers, and residential treatment settings. And as we've delved into the interventions
represent a failure in treatment that can cause trauma and injury to clients and staff. And so the leadership group that we formed promotes alternatives through research, policy analysis, outreach, technical assistance, and education. In 2014, we awarded a grant to our friends at Texas Network of Youth Services to assume the coordination of the leadership group. Since then, they have been building upon and making use of the knowledge base that the leadership group has developed in order to further its work toward reducing the widespread use of seclusion and restraint. To find out more about the history of this particular initiative and recent developments, you can just look for it on the Hogg Foundation website and also the Texas Network of Youth Services, or TNOYS, website. And that's www.tnoys.org. And that does it for this episode of Into the Fold. Please sign up for the podcast newsletter. If you go to our main website, www.hogg.utexas.edu, in the top level navigation under the News and Resources dropdown, there is a link to the podcast landing page. And there, you can sign up for the Into the Fold e-newsletter. We're always interested in any advice or suggestions on how we could be doing this differently or better. Thanks so much for joining us.